يقولون سلام سلام ولا هنا سلام.
You're listening to Middle East Analysis, a podcast series from the Catholic Bishops' Conference of England and Wales. I'm joined again today by Dr. Harry Hagopian, consultant to the Bishops' Conference on the Middle East. Harry, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, James.
How are you doing?
I'm a bit tired, but that's to be expected these days.
Plenty happening in the world, plenty happening in the Middle East, of course, North Africa as well. So let's start with that. I mean, who can fail to have seen the pictures on television? The focus has shifted. We've been talking all along about the spark in Tunisia and how that's moved along. Now we're really starting to talk about Libya. Give us an update on it as you see it. And of course, we've had Colonel Gaddafi appearing on TV having his say as well.
Yes, well, his say or his rant, as it might be. But it's interesting, James, because, yes, on previous occasions we've talked about the spark that started in Tunisia, and then the big one was Egypt, where that spark basically was consolidated. And now it's playing it out in Bahrain, in Yemen, and in Libya. And, of course, of those three, the bloodiest and most violent at the moment, as we've seen on many of our television screens, is Libya. I mean, it is mind-boggling, some of the pictures I've seen on different satellite channels. And of course, Libya itself now is being fragmented because the whole of the eastern part of Libya, in other words, Benghazi and the major cities and towns around it, are out of the control of the Libyan forces and of Gaddafi's army. He is holding on to the capital, Tripoli, but I'm sure that as we speak, that hold could be weakening as well.
Do you think the people have the stomach after such bloodshed to actually take on Tripoli, which, let's be honest, is a completely different ballgame to Benghazi?
It is a completely different ballgame in different ways. It is the center for Gaddafi's power base. It is also a place where allegedly there are thousands upon thousands of mercenaries, most of them from Africa, who've come and are fighting, are being paid to fight the Libyan people on behalf of the regime. And in a sense, I would say that after all the sacrifices and the 300 or 400 deaths at least that have been reported by Human Rights Watch and other organizations, if anything, it would have strengthened the resolve of the people that having sacrificed so much already, they're not going to stop halfway and they're going to go to the very end. And the very end at the moment is to get rid of another dictator, but in this case, a very violent and somewhat unhinged dictator whom we hated in the West at some stage and then we courted him at some other stage. And the next day or two, I believe, are going to be critical in the sense of where all this revolution in Libya goes.
How can you court someone one minute and hate them the next? Doesn't that affect Western credibility? I mean, either he's someone that is so bad that the West isn't interested in him holding power, or he's not. Isn't it that simple?
Well, at the end of the day, it's not that simple, James. It's even simpler, and the simpler answer that it's all got to do with vested interests, and vested interests are political and economic. Libya is a massive oil producer to a West that guzzles oil, so we consume it and we need it. The second thing is political interests. The strategic interests of the West are played out by having somebody in Libya who is not fighting against you, as he did at some stage when he was supporting the IRA against the British. So in that sense, as Lord Palmerston said, politics is all about interests. And I think that we thought that we had won him over in the sense that we'd neutralized his more radical tendencies. But of course, with the Arab Spring or Arab Revolution going across the whole Middle East, North Africa region, I think the whole formula has become a bit skewered, and we find him now basically accusing everybody from the Libyan people to the West for conspiring to overthrow him, and he does not yet realize that a lot of the fault lies within himself and his regime.
Now, I've been looking at your latest article on your website, epictarsis.net, Struggling for the Arab Soul. It's got religious overtones, of course, but it's actually quite provocative, I think, as a title as well. So tell me what you were driving at with that.
Well, what I was trying to say in this article, which hopefully you would link into this podcast, James, is that we are no longer only talking about self-respect and dignity and human rights and social justice. The Arab world has been a very vibrant world over centuries. And then in the last few decades, certainly since the late 70s or early 80s, it flatlined. The Arab world became a shell, an empty shell. It didn't make its own decisions. There was no sense of forward movement, both in terms of creativity, education, achievements, political impetus in the world. The Arabs basically became servile to the rest of the world. And a lot of Arab intellectuals were wondering, why is this happening? I mean, a wonderful book on that is a book by a university professor, Elizabeth Kassab, who talks about Arab contemporary thought, which was published by Columbia University Press last year, in which she basically underlines that Arab intellectual thought is very much there. The problem is that the regimes aren't allowing those intellectuals to breathe or to come out and market their thoughts. So the sense of freedom within which they could operate, within which new and creative ideas could enter into the marketplace, as it were, was being snuffed out by oppressive regimes, authoritarian structures that wanted to keep power to themselves and therefore isolated from the people. And what is happening now is that this whole movement, this revolution, this series of uprisings, this Arab Spring, as some people are calling it, in my opinion, goes to the very fundamental concept of what it means to be Arab and to link your present with your past in all its failures and achievements, because we in Europe have had our fair share of failures and achievements as well. So link it with your failures and achievements, but at least there is emotion, and then move forward rather than be stultified in a space where you pretty much do not count or you do as you are told.
I think that's very eloquent, and it makes me think that if we now say that we're hearing from the Arab soul, looking at the oppression and the brutal attempts to put down its voice, if you like, the voice of the masses, what is happening with regard to the Christian communities? I know obviously in Libya they're smaller, but there are Copts in Libya, I believe. There was some criticism, wasn't there, of the Coptic Church in Egypt
in terms of
not maybe being as vocal as it should have been. Yeah. Talk to us a little bit about
Well, the problem with the Christian communities, insofar as it is a problem, James, is that they are a small community within a wider political space. And therefore, as is the case with all smaller communities, you automatically become self-protective and you're always careful about how to behave, what to say and what not to say. And sometimes you tend to align yourself with those whom you think are in power or who have the power, because it's an instinct by which you think that you are protecting your own identity. Now, this is a cultural thing. It might not happen everywhere in the world, but it certainly happens in the Middle East. And the Coptic Church, as well as other churches, in terms of institutions and leaders and hierarchs, has received its fair share of criticism because sometimes they haven't spoken out quite bravely, boldly, prophetically about the need for change and about the precious value of the human being, every human being who's been created in the image and likeness of God. If you believe in that, you cannot accept human beings being treated like rabble. And therefore, when the church as an institution has sometimes held back from proclaiming the teachings of the gospel for the sake of stability, security, and self-interest, dare I say sometimes, then I think it goes against the grain of any Christian as to why this is happening. But at the same time, culturally and politically, it becomes understandable because they are trying to protect their interests and as such, the interests of their their communities. However, I believe also, James, that the Christian communities, whether in Egypt, whether in Iraq, in certainly in Lebanon, where, for instance, the leader of the largest Lebanese Christian community, the Maronite community, Cardinal Sfer, is today, as we speak, in Rome, where a statue of Saint Maroun, the founder of the Maronite Catholic Church, is being placed in the facade of Saint Peter's Basilica. So in a sense, all those Christians have played a major, major part in the civilizational prospects and progress of the Arab world across the whole Middle East, North Africa region. And therefore, they not only have a heritage there that is undeniable, but they also have a right to speak out and a right to reclaim their citizenship rights equal to those of others, be they Muslims or be they Jews in Israel.
Let's look at us in the West just for a second. You talked about, and hopefully you'll tell us a bit more about the UN vote, the veto.
Oh, yes.
Last week. I'm just thinking, aren't we somewhat responsible? This doesn't make the West look great either, does it? Really? Because you said we've had our vested interests. Our behaviour has in some way been pushed down a track that matches our interests. So this mess is our fault as well, isn't it?
It is our fault on different levels. It is our fault, first of all, if we want to go historically, and I think we in the West have accepted that to a large extent. We have a colonial past, which in some sense makes us understand the Middle East and North Africa better than many other people, certainly better than the Americans, because we've been there, we've seen it, we've done it. But it doesn't excuse us for actually colonizing another people. However, we have already had those colonial excesses in the past. I mean, all you need to do is go to Channel 4 and watch a program called The Promise, 4 episodes, which talks about the British mandate of that whole Transjordanian Palestinian area, and that sort of gives you a flavor of where we were in the early 1900s. So in a sense, we have that. The other thing we also have is the fact that we have flip-flopped to a large extent during this revolution. In Tunisia, we wanted to speak out, but we didn't want to speak out. In Egypt, we weren't sure whether we should be clear to say that Mubarak should go or whether we shouldn't do that. Even now, despite the bloodbath taking place in Libya and the atrocities being committed by the regime, we still have, and by we, I don't only mean the UK, but we in the UK have sometimes actually said more than many other European partners, but we in the West, the United Nations, the various organizations across the world have shied away from basically taking any decisive action to stop what I think is nothing short of ethnic cleansing of certain tribes in Libya today. So in a sense, we also are responsible for not speaking out. We are responsible in the sense that we have supported those who are now oppressing their peoples, whether by giving them licenses to buy arms, whether by supporting them politically or economically, whether by being dependent on them for oil and therefore closing our eyes to human rights violations. All this have come together, and now what we don't seem to realize, and by we here I mean mostly the US administration, is that unlike the rest of the world, unlike our own foreign minister William Hagan, unlike the European Union, the Americans haven't yet cottoned on to the fact that the hub of the whole Middle East is Israel-Palestine. If the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is resolved peacefully in a win-win scenario where Israel gets security alongside Palestine, but the Palestinians get the right to establish their own state, then that would diffuse much of the tensions of the Middle East. And yet, for an American administration whose president went to Turkey, to Ankara, and to Cairo in Egypt in 2009, and spoke about peace and justice and stretching out a hand to the Muslims, and then being the only country in the United Nations Security Council to veto a resolution that was sponsored by 130 UN member states out of 192. So we're talking about an overwhelming 60-70% of the members, and supported by every other United Nations Security Council member save America, that would qualify settlements in Israel as being illegal. What message does that send to the Arab world? What message does that send to the Muslim world? It sends the message that we're still hugely biased, very blinkered in the way we look at foreign policy, and we cannot seem to understand that sometimes tough love between states, just as between individuals, is the best kind of love.
Let me quote something to you from your latest article, and because I think this also is the crux of the matter here.
Mm-hmm.
When talking about freedom for Arabs, you say that the local regimes, well, we need to help them understand that representation, not ostracism, would be the better tool of good governance and long-term interests. Now, Gaddafi's not going to be won over by that one, is he?
Of course he's not going to be won over by that, because Gaddafi would probably think I'm the biggest nutter on the face of the earth. And if he stops at that, I would be quite happy. If I were there, I probably wouldn't be talking to you today. But no, he wouldn't understand that. But also, what I think we've learned, and as I were talking off mic a few minutes ago when I told you I did an interview with Vatican Radio yesterday, where I was saying that this whole thesis that we've had in the past in the West, that if we support autocracies in the Middle East, those autocracies would bring stability into the region, which would provide us with security in the West, and which would prevent political Islam from taking hold in that region and therefore bringing the troubles into our shores. This whole idea has turned on its head, because what we are realizing now, and Prime Minister David Cameron said it, although I, like many, many other people, were surprised, to put it mildly, that he decided to visit the Middle East this week when the whole place is still up in the air. But what I think we should realize is that for stability to be real in that part of the world, the people have to speak, the people have to be empowered, the people have to have a sense of dignity and respect, the people have to have representation and a voice. If you do that, most people are sensible, normal people who are much more interested in raising families and paying the bills at the end of the month than they are at going and blowing people up. That applies to Africa, to Asia, to the Middle East, to Europe, to Americas, everywhere across the world. There are nutters all over the world. We have our fair share of nutters, as do others in other parts of the world. But the majority of the people, if dealt with and treated with respect and with dignity, usually respond with respect and with dignity.
Well, I think because of the fact that this is a story evolving almost to the minute, we'll take on a few of these issues perhaps next week. So what I'd like you to do, Harry, is to just, prediction's a dangerous thing, I acknowledge that, but tell me a little bit about where you see it going with regard to Libya. Touch a bit for me, please, on Bahrain and also Yemen. And as you've mentioned before, the elephant in the room, it all comes back to Israel-Palestine.
It does. That is the big elephant in the room, James. And predictions aren't really my craft. But the way things are going at the moment, I can't see how the Libyan regime could actually survive. I can see a lot of challenges facing Yemen and Bahrain. And if the Bahraini king manages to play this wisely, changes his government, enters into negotiations with a predominantly Shi'i population ruled by a Sunni elite, if Yemen, which is a very tribal, clannish society, manages to find common voice with people, then maybe they would be able to stop this effervescence there and then. But I don't really sound too convinced, even of my own thoughts and voice, because this is a momentum. And in a sense, I said this way before when it started with Tunisia and Egypt. After decades and decades, the political Arab genie has come out of the bottle. And once the genie is out of the bottle, it's very difficult to put it back into the bottle. So Bahrain, Yemen and Libya are where it is playing out now. But let us also, as Christians, as citizens of this world, as interested people, also keep an eye on Morocco, keep an eye on Jordan, and even keep an eye on the Palestinian territories, where on the one hand you have a virulent occupation of one people by another, but on the other hand you have a Palestinian people who is divided so dangerously and so painfully between those in Gaza and those in the West Bank. All the makeup of the region is, to my mind, a pretty artificial makeup. And these are some of the fault lines that are now beginning to play out. And let me add one teaser, if I may, James, which we might then take up on another occasion with another podcast. Let us also keep an eye on Iran. Because when we talk about the Middle East and North Africa, we tend to forget Iran. But there have been huge demonstrations and brutal repression in that country 2 years ago, last year, and only a couple of weeks ago again. So the regime there is also having problems. Will this revolution spread there, or will it be checked by the repressive tools of yet another regime? Again, as I've said many a time, I'm not a prophet.
Well, Harry, I hope our listeners will forgive me for bringing prayer in literally at the 11th hour at the end of our podcast. But clearly there are plenty of people that we do need to pray for. So I think we should offer our prayers for all the people suffering in the region.
We should do that, James. And as you know, I just came from a meeting of the International Affairs Department of the Bishops' Conference of England and Wales here in this same building. And Bishop Declan Lann, who presides this department, actually started with a very moving prayer for all the troubles of the world, and particularly those in the Middle East and North Africa. Prayer is powerful, and with prayer comes information and hope, and hopefully also action.
Amen.
Amen.
Dr. Harry Hagopian there, international lawyer, political expert and analyst, and needless to say, consultant to the Catholic Bishops' Conference of England and Wales on the Middle East. Thank you, Harry.
Thank you, James.